Welcome to Washington Today for Friday, May 27th, 2022. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Here are some of today's headlines. People gathered outside the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, Texas, to protest the National Rifle Association's annual meeting there, which begins today. We'll have more on that event in just a moment. In Buffalo, New York, federal officials investigating the May 14th racially motivated shooting that killed 10 African Americans at a Buffalo grocery store are trying to find out if a retired federal agent from Texas knew about the shooting just 30 minutes before it happened. The Buffalo News reports 18-year-old Peyton Gendron invited around 30 people in a chat room devoted to racism, including the unnamed retired agent from the unnamed agency, to read his writings and plans before the shooting at Top Supermarket in Buffalo. We'll have an update on the latest with the victims and their families coming up. And a bipartisan group of senators is considering how Congress should respond to the shooting of 19 children and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas, which, of course, is restarting gun legislation talks that have broken down many times before. Eris Foley from The Hill has that update soon. We begin in Uvalde, Texas, where the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety gave an emotional update on the mass shooting that took place at Robb Elementary on Tuesday, May 24th, 2022.
And now I'd like to go over the 911 timeline. So I warn you, it's not. It's better that I read it than you listen to it. The caller identified, I'll not say her name, but she was in room 112, called 911 at 12:03. The duration of the call was 1 minute and 23 seconds. She identified herself and whispered she's in room 112. At 12:10, she called back in room 12, advised her multiple dead. 12:13, again she called on the phone. Again at 12:16, she called back and said there was 8 to 9 students alive. At 12:19, a 911 call was made, and another person in room 111 called. I will not say her name. She hung up when another student told her to hang up. At 12:21, you could hear over the 911 call that 3 shots were fired. At 12:36, 911 call, it lasted for 21 seconds. The initial caller called back, student, child, called back, was told to stay on the line and be very quiet. She told 911 that he shot the door. At approximately 12:43 and 12:47, she asked 911 to please send the police now. At 12:46, she said she could hear the police next door. At 12:50, shots are fired. They can be heard over the 911 call. And at 12:51, is very loud and sounds like the officers are moving children out of the room. At that time, the first child that called was outside before the call cuts off.
Colonel Stephen McGraw addressed the mounting public anger and scrutiny over law enforcement's response to Tuesday's shooting.
You say there were 19 officers gathered in the hallway or somewhere. What efforts were made to try and break through that door? You say it was locked. What efforts were the officers making to try and break through either that door or another door to get inside that classroom?
None at that time. The on-scene commander at the time believed that it had transitioned from an active shooter to a barricaded subject.
Sir, you have people who are alive, children who are calling 911 saying, please send the police. They are alive in that classroom. There are lives that are at risk.
Hey,
that's not protocol,
is it? We're well aware of that.
Right, yeah. But why was this decision made not to go in and rescue these children?
Again, you know, the on-scene commander considered it a barricaded subject and that there was time and there were no more children at risk. Obviously, you know, based upon the information we have, there were children in that classroom that were at risk, and it was, in fact, still an active shooter situation and not a barricaded subject.
So, sir, if I can follow up.
Responding to reporters, Director McGraw explained why officers had not been able to stop the shooter sooner.
What can you tell parents that were here waiting and asking for the police to go in?
Did you do an apology for them?
And there was 19, like I said, there was 19 officers in there. In fact, there was plenty of officers to do whatever needed to be done, with one exception, is that the incident commander inside believed they needed more equipment and more officers to do a tactical breach at that point. That's why BORTAC was requested on the scene. As soon as they were there, they executed, they searched, or at least a dynamic entry, and went in. And of course, that was not the 12th. That was not the 12th. From the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. But again, I wasn't there, but I'm just telling you, from what we know, we believe there should have been an entry at that as soon as you can. Hey, when there's an active shooter, the rules change. It's no longer, okay, it's no longer a barricaded subject. You don't have time. You don't worry about outer perimeters. And by the way, Texas embraces active shooter training, active shooter certification, and that doctrine requires officers. We don't care what agency you're from. You don't have to have a leader on the scene. Every officer lines up, stacks up, goes and finds where those rounds are being fired at, and keeps shooting until the subject is dead, period.
The 18-year-old shooter, Salvador Ramos, shot and killed 19 students and two teachers at Robb Elementary School on Tuesday. He was on the premises for about an hour before law enforcement forcibly entered a classroom and killed him. Now, about 270 miles away in Houston, Texas, the National Rifle Association began its annual convention. Former President Donald Trump spoke.
As we mourn for so many beautiful victims, I know that everyone here joins me in praying for the families who are suddenly missing the brightest light in their lives. We see their agony. We ask God to ease their suffering and to heal their pain. And together we grieve side by side as one great American family. Now is the time to find common ground. Sadly, before the sun had even set on the horrible day of tragedy, we witnessed a now familiar parade of cynical politicians seeking to exploit the tears of sobbing families to increase their own power and take away our constitutional rights. Every time a disturbed or demented person commits such a hideous crime, there's always a grotesque effort by some in our society to use the suffering of others to advance their own extreme political agenda. Even more repulsive is their rush to shift blame away from the villains who commit acts of mass violence and to place that blame onto the shoulders of millions of peaceful, law-abiding citizens who belong to organizations such as our wonderful NRA. When Joe Biden blamed the gun lobby, he was talking about Americans like you. And along with countless other Democrats this week, he was shamefully suggesting that Republicans are somehow okay with letting school shootings happen. They're not okay with it. This rhetoric is highly divisive and dangerous, and most importantly, it's wrong. It has no place in our politics. As always, in the wake of these tragedies, the various gun control policies being pushed by the left would have done nothing to prevent the horror that took place, absolutely nothing. Unfortunately, ever since Columbine, we've been afflicted by a contagion of school shootings carried out by deeply evil, violent, and mentally disturbed young men. While we don't yet know enough about this week's killing, we know there are many things we must do. We need to drastically change our approach to mental health. There are always so many warning signs. Almost all of these disfigured minds share the same profile. When people see something, whether on social media or in school, they need to say something. Teachers, parents, school officials, and community members need to be recognizing and addressing these alarm bells promptly and very, very aggressively. And our school discipline systems, instead of making excuses and continually turning a blind eye, need to confront bad behavior head on and quickly.
Also speaking at the convention, NRA President Wayne LaPierre.
We do not agree with President Biden on the Second Amendment, but we share common ground on this. Last week, the president said, "I'm not naive. I know tragedy will come again. It cannot be forever overcome. It cannot be fully understood either. But there are certain things we can do." NRA members know that to be true. There are absolutely certain things we can and must do. Where we part ways with the president and many in his party is on the policy question and what we can and should do to prevent the hate-filled, vile monsters who walk among us from committing their evil. Restricting the fundamental human right of law-abiding Americans to defend themselves is not the answer. It never has been. Each year, over 1 million law-abiding men and women use a firearm to save their own lives and the lives of their loved ones. That is over 1 million innocent Americans every year who owe their lives and the lives of their loved ones to their Second Amendment rights. Taking away their right to self-defense is not the answer.
NRA President Wayne LaPierre. Texas Senator Ted Cruz also spoke at the conference.
At the same time, it is incumbent on us to understand what is behind these evil attacks. You know, when we were growing up, this kind of thing didn't happen. Kids may have worried about getting into a fist fight at school, maybe a bloody nose at recess, but we never worried about a psychopath coming into our classrooms to commit murder. The elites who dominate our culture tell us that firearms lie at the root of the problem. By elites, I refer to some of the most powerful politicians and their allies in the media, the leaders of the largest corporations and many of the most famous celebrities, and those who echo and amplify them. Their resources are limitless. Their megaphone is enormous. And their voice can be deafening. Many of these same people make their accusations from behind great bulwarks of safety, from gated communities equipped with private security, or at the very least, from safe and expensive neighborhoods protected by high home prices and low crime rates. Such people can afford an indulgent ideology that ignores reality. As is so often the case, those furthest from the halls of power are the most dependent on the ability to defend themselves. For millions of Americans, the right to keep and bear arms is not theoretical, it's not abstract. For a single mom in a dangerous neighborhood, it is a matter of basic security. Taking guns away from these responsible Americans will not make them safer. Nor will it make our nation more secure. In an age where elites embrace defunding the police, when homelessness runs rampant, when gangs dominate entire communities, and when radical district attorneys refuse to prosecute violent crime in cities across America, rarely has the Second Amendment been more necessary to secure the rights of our fellow citizens. But many would still tell us that the evil on display in Uvalde or in Buffalo derives from the presence of guns in the hands of ordinary American citizens. It's far easier to slander one's political adversaries and to demand that responsible citizens forfeit their constitutional rights than it is to examine the cultural sickness giving birth to unspeakable acts of evil. It's far less comfortable to ask why despair and isolation and violent hatred is so prevalent in America. It requires a sick soul to drive a truck into a crowded sidewalk, to plant a bomb at a marathon, or to fly a plane into a building. It requires a sick soul to open fire in a movie theater, or in a church, or in a school.
Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Meanwhile, God Bless the USA singer Lee Greenwood has decided not to attend and perform at the National Rifle Association conference this weekend. Speaking on Fox and Friends Friday morning, Greenwood said, quote, "For me to go and play at the NRA just days after the shooting would be an endorsement," end quote. Greenwood joins American Pie singer Don McLean, country music singer Larry Gatlin, and Larry Stewart of Restless Heart, who have also pulled out of performing at the annual National Rifle Association convention in Houston this weekend. We turn now to Buffalo, New York, where three more funerals are taking place in a week of goodbyes. On Saturday, Vice President Kamala Harris and her husband Doug Emhoff will attend the memorial service of Ruth Whitfield. Ruth Whitfield is one of the victims of the racially motivated May 14th shooting that killed 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Now, according to a White House statement, the second family will also meet with families of other victims to offer their condolences. Senate GOP signals an openness to talking about gun legislation. That headline from The Hill by Eris Foley, congressional reporter at The Hill. We've heard passionate pleas from different groups in the media about how nothing ever happens after these school shootings. Eris Foley, based on your research and reporting, what's different this time?
Right. I think that's up for debate, right, between some Democrats and some Republicans. There definitely are Democrats who are encouraged, right, by the fact that GOP leadership this time around is saying that they are supporting these bipartisan talks. But there are Republicans, there are Democrats who are skeptical on both sides of the aisle of these discussions yielding an actual solution, just because Republicans have been so opposed consistently to new federal gun laws in the past. However, right now, Democrats involved in these talks are saying that they're at least open and willing to look at a more narrow path forward in hopes of obtaining meaningful legislation that can secure 60 votes in a 50-50 Senate. And there are Republicans who are also bringing up proposals that they are interested in. So though talks are very early right now, there is some hope on both sides of the aisle that this could possibly yield some kind of solution on a path forward.
And which senators are leading this effort?
I think mainly we've been seeing Murphy. He's been just a really strong advocate when it comes to gun reform in the past. We've also seen Blumenthal. Cornyn was recently tapped by Senator McConnell to also participate in talks with Democrats on gun reform. And there have been also just other senators that have expressed interest. I know that Toomey has been coming up and saying that he's at least interested in red flag legislation. You've seen Collins. I think there are just a number of senators on both sides of the aisle that have expressed some kind of interest in these types of conversations, but particularly leading them, I would say Murphy, Blumenthal, and just recently again McConnell tapping Cornyn also help guide these conversations and see what possible path there is there for a compromise bill. If possible, or some type of legislation.
And based on your reporting and research, what are the specific proposals that are possibly of interest to both sides?
Well, we have seen Republicans showing an interest in measures like expanding background checks, but I think mainly what we've been seeing most of right now in talks is red flag legislation. I know that I think there are probably 19 states that have implemented such laws that, you know, are focused on kind of limiting firearm access for people who are at risk of harming themselves, harming others. there isn't that much of an appetite, it seems like, right now for enacting something like this on kind of, or making this a federal requirement, but leadership has said that there is at least a general feeling, right, among Republicans that it would be better maybe to incentivize states than making this kind of a nationwide mandate. But again, talks are also very early.
Well, Congress is gone for a week. What can we expect when they come back?
I guess we'll see. I know that even Senator Murphy, who is helping lead these conversations right now, has, you know, said earlier this week that there might be less than a 50-50 chance of maybe them finding some type of bipartisan compromise. But there at least is a willingness on both sides to, right now, while the conversations are so early, to hear each other out and what proposals might be able to stick. But I know that Murphy said that he will be continuing conversations during the break because there is kind of a time crunch right now, somewhat. I know that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is giving bipartisan talks a chance to find a solution. But he's also made clear that if the negotiations do not, you know, in his words, bear fruit, the Senate will take up gun safety legislation when they return from this current Memorial Day recess.
So what type of response, then, is this bipartisan effort receiving, given the information you just gave me?
Right. I think that people are encouraged. I mean, there are progressive Democrats. You have a Warren or a Booker who are a little bit, you know, just because of have an action in situations like this, we've seen, you know, an action. And a lot of Democrats feel like we might have been here before, right? And understandable, you know, there hasn't been, they point to inaction after Parkland, they point to inaction after Sandy Hook, after Charleston, Sally, there are a long list of high profile shootings. So there definitely are Democrats who are putting more so the pressure on Republicans to say what proposals they're supportive of and kind of taking this, you know, we'll believe it when we see it. But as of right now, I mean, are, you know, basically highlighting the fact that there is such a tall task ahead of this bipartisan groups of senators and trying to get some type of compromise on something so partisan in a 50-50 Senate. But on the other hand, there are also Democrats who say they're encouraged. I know Manchin said that this felt different. There have been Republican senators who feel like this is different. The energy right now, the national energy, but also the energy that we're seeing in the Senate to try and find a bipartisan compromise. So it's really a mixed bag.
Eris Foley, congressional reporter. Find her reporting at thehill.com. Thank you so much for keeping us updated on what's happening with gun legislation in Congress. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. You're the same.
Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are a few more headlines. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tells Bloomberg News that Russian forces are making, quote, palpable progress in eastern Ukraine and that Kyiv's forces need long-range rocket launchers and other military support. Britain's defense ministry said Friday that Moscow's troops have recently captured several villages in the eastern Donbass region but do not yet have full control of the region. Recounting began Friday in the too-close-to-call Republican primary contest for U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania. That's with barely 900 votes separating celebrity heart surgeon Dr. Mehmet Oz and former hedge fund CEO David McCormick. For less populated counties, the recount process could take a day. More heavily populated counties say they'll need several days. Counties have until June 7th to finish a recount and another day to report results to the state. The World Health Organization says nearly 200 cases of monkeypox have been reported in more than 20 countries not usually known to have outbreaks of the disease. During a public briefing on Friday, the UN Health Agency described the epidemic as, quote, containable and proposed creating a stockpile to equitably share the limited vaccines and drugs available worldwide. We continue now in Annapolis, Maryland, where President Biden gave the commencement address at the Naval Academy graduation. The president urged this year's graduating class of midshipmen to be stewards of strong American leadership abroad as the world faces major challenges, including Russia's war in Ukraine.
To state the obvious, no generation of graduates gets to pick what world they're going to live, we're going to graduate into. It's already been formed for you. But you must change it. No officer knows the range of challenges they'll face when they commission. In class of 2022, you are graduating at an inflection point not only in American history, but in world history, and I mean it. The challenges we face, the choices we make, are more consequential than ever. Things are changing so rapidly that the next 10 years will be the decisive decade of this century, because it's going to shape what our world looks like and the values that will guide it, not just for the immediate future, but for generations to come. And that is not hyperbole. Over the past few years, we've seen how interconnected the world is. The deadly pandemic has impacted not just our own schooling, but almost every aspect of our lives. Impacts of disruptions in the global supply chain, causing significant inflation, accelerated a climate crisis that's leading to rising seas and more severe weather patterns around the globe, and Putin's brutal war in Ukraine. Not only is he trying to take over Ukraine, he's literally trying to wipe out the culture and identity of the Ukrainian people, attacking schools, nurseries, hospitals, museums, with no other purpose than eliminate a culture. A direct assault on the fundamental tenets of rule-based international order. That's what you're graduating into. That's the world in which ensigns and second lieutenants, a world that more than ever requires strong, principled, engaged American leadership, where America leads not only by the example of its power, but the power of its example. Think of why most nations agree to support us. It's example. It's example, we said.
Speaking of the Russian-Ukraine war, Secretary of State Antony Blinken responded to questions on Finland and Sweden joining NATO.
On expanding NATO, have you seen any progress towards getting Turkey on board? And what are you willing to do? What demands are you willing to satisfy in order to move that process along? Also, secondly, Mr. Secretary, you spoke with your Ukrainian counterpart today about security assistance. Is supplying American long-range missile systems on the table?
Thank you. I think as you heard from the Foreign Minister, Finland and Sweden are working directly with Turkey to address some of the concerns that it raised. We're also talking to Turkey. I saw the Turkish Foreign Minister in New York about a week ago, and those conversations continue. I don't want to characterize the conversations beyond saying that, first, there is a very strong consensus in NATO for the admission of Finland and Sweden, and I remain confident that we will work through this process swiftly, and that things will move forward with both countries. As Pekka said, it is a process. In that process, countries raise concerns that they may have. We work through them. That's what Finland and Sweden are doing right now with Turkey, and I'm confident that this will move forward. With regard to security assistance to Ukraine, yes, I spoke to my counterpart, Dmytro Kuleba, this morning. We speak regularly, and this is a constant conversation about the, among other things, the needs that Ukraine has to make sure that it has in hand what it needs to deal with the Russian aggression, as well as ultimately to strengthen the hand that it will have at any negotiating table that emerges in the future. And that's a constant process. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin set up what I think is a very effective mechanism when he brought about 40 countries together at Ramstein, Germany, a couple of weeks ago. So there's now an active contact group bringing all these countries together to focus the assistance that Ukraine needs and to make sure that countries are doing what they need to do to provide it. I'm not going to get ahead of that process, including with future deliveries of assistance. All of that is in train and will unfold in the days and weeks ahead.
Maybe from our side, first, just to mention our Prime Minister, Sanna Marin, visited 2 days ago Kiev and also Bucha, and of course was shocked what she saw there and all the destruction, and Finland is committed to continue supporting Ukraine, and we have been also sending the lethal packages to Ukraine. The military support to Ukraine is very important at this moment. Then regarding Turkey, our delegations visited actually Wednesday. both from Sweden and Finland. Turkey had a good negotiations there, long negotiations, agreed to continue those talks. And of course, we rely on NATO open door policy, which is also supported by Turkey. And we think that these problems can be solved, that which Turkey has been raising. And it's probably very important that some results could be achieved before the Madrid summit, which is an important moment for NATO and also for us as applicant countries in the end of June.
At the State Department, Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Meanwhile, at the Pentagon, Press Secretary John Kirby spoke about the assistance the U.S. is giving to help Ukraine continue to fight Russian troops.
That they are now, Ukraine is at a real risk of losing the Donbas region.
I won't make predictions on the battlefield. We've also tried to stay away from that. It is in many ways a very close and intimate fight. I think I've described it as a knife fight, and that's not an inaccurate way of putting it. There are places, towns, villages, hamlets that the Russians and Ukrainians are in very close contact. And it's very dynamic, as I said yesterday. There are towns and villages which fall to the Russians on a given day, and then the Ukrainians will recover that days later. There's still a lot of back and forth. And I don't think being predictive about how long it's going to take or who's going to win is a useful exercise right now. What we are focused on is making sure that the Ukrainians can succeed on the battlefield. And again, that's the nature of the conversations that we have. The last thing I'll say, and I know everybody's interested in what's going to be in the next package and what's not. I understand that. I'm just not going to get ahead of where we are. But I do think it's important to remind that with the supplemental request now, we now have available to us several billions of dollars more just in drawdown authority, let alone assistance initiative contracting funds to help Ukraine in this fight. And we're going to marshal and use that resource just as smartly as we've done for the last sets of drawdown packages, the last 10 that we've done, and the next one will be 11. We're going to be smart about this, and we're going to be in lockstep with the Ukrainians and with our allies and partners about it. And there will, 11 won't be the end of it. There will be more. And we'll do them deliberately in a sequenced way so that the kind of assistance Ukraine's getting makes sense for the fight that they're in. We want to see them succeed. We want them to have not only success on the battlefield, but success in the outcomes here. And so we're going to be flexible going forward.
Speaking at the Department of Defense, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. Officials from the G7 nations announced Friday that they will aim to largely end greenhouse gas emissions from their power sectors by 2035, making it highly unlikely that those countries will burn coal for electricity beyond that date. Meeting in Berlin, the Associated Press is reporting that ministers from the G7 countries also announced a target to have, quote, highly decarbonized road sector by 2030, meaning that electric vehicles would dominate new car sales by the end of the decade. The agreements were largely welcomed by climate activists. And speaking of vehicles, soaring gas prices have Americans bracing for an expensive Memorial Day weekend, which is the traditional start of the summer when vacation-related travel typically spikes. TheHill.com reporting that despite the increases last week, every state had gas prices over $4 for the first time ever. AAA is predicting travel for the three-day weekend will return to near pre-pandemic levels, which for car travel in particular, the group predicts levels will reach 93% of pre-pandemic volume. And a reminder that this program is available as a podcast. Listen anytime at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today.